I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today about truth and reconciliation with South Africans and Liberians trying to achieve both. But first, the Bush administration today announced unprecedented unilateral sanctions against Iran, reportedly for the first time in U.S. history, specifically targeting the military of a country, in this case, the Revolutionary Guard Corps and Quds Force, part of Iran's defense ministry. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said the sanctions would cut off Iran's military and state-owned banks from the American financial system.
In dealing with Iran, it is nearly impossible to know one's customer and be assured that one is not unwittingly facilitating the regime's reckless behavior and conduct.
Well, joining us on the line is Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Michael, characterize this for us, because there are already sanctions against Iran. What's the importance of this announcement today?
Well, this is clearly ramping up the pressure on Iran and ramping up the potential for a confrontation with Iran. What the administration is doing here is designating a rather significant arm of the Iranian government for sanctions, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, as a weapons proliferator. They're imposing sanctions on a whole range of financial transactions that the IRGC engages in. And in addition, it is specifying one branch of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, as a terrorist organization. That in and of itself is a pretty provocative act, given that it is an arm of the Iranian government. Well, when you're branding an arm of the government as a terrorist organization, it unquestionably is is an escalation in U.S. actions.
Well, the thinking comes as no surprise to the Iranian government, but remind us, what's the difference between the Revolutionary Guard and the Quds Force?
The Quds Force is a part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's the foreign covert arm of the Guard Corps, and it has been the part of the Guard Corps that has been active in Iraq, arming Shia militias that have been attacking U.S. forces. It has also been responsible for the arming and training of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza, both of which are designated terrorist organizations by the U.S. government. So it more closely draws the link between terrorist enemies of the United States, or at least as the United States brands them as enemies, and the Iranian government.
Well, the guards, the Quds Force, we're not just talking about a standing army. The Revolutionary Guards now operate car factories, construction firms, newspapers, oil fields. The BBC reporting that the guards oversee about a third of Iran's economy. So, a money trail, one would understand the White House wanting to pursue the money trail. Will it have an effect, though?
It's hard to say. I mean, first of all, there are no assets. There's not likely to be any assets found inside the United States that these organizations can be directly tied to. But when you're talking about foreign banks and foreign financial institutions that do business with Iran, they are put at risk in terms of doing business with the United States. So that's a way for the United States to put pressure on these financial pressure on these organizations indirectly rather than directly, because, as I said, you're not going to find their assets in the United States anyway.
Well, and what do you think that effect will be? We just saw Russia's Putin travel to Iran. Will this declaration have any impact on foreign banks?
It's hard to say. It may have an impact on some. There's a lot of ways to skirt these sanctions. They've rarely been as effective as their implementers would like to believe. But I think the longer term impact, or the more important impact, is going to be political. This definitely sort of escalates the potential for a confrontation with the United States and Iran.
Michael, Mr. Isikoff, in just a few seconds we have, do you think that the administration is in fact preparing for war, or is this just to allay the fears of the hawks that it's not?
Well, I think that there's a continuing battle within the administration about how aggressive and tough to get with Iran, and a continuing battle inside the Congress as well. It's worth remembering that it was just a few weeks ago that the Senate voted overwhelmingly for the Lieberman Amendment, which actually would have gone further than this this step was, because the Lieberman Amendment that Hillary Clinton, among others, supported, was to brand the entire Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. The administration didn't go quite as far as that. They branded them as, for sanctions, as a weapons proliferator, but carved out just the Quds Force as a terrorist organization.
To be continued. Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, Do They Do Justice to Justice? That's the title of a conference being held at the University of Massachusetts Boston this week. Former enemies from Northern Ireland and Serbia are sitting down with representatives from Chile, Guatemala, El Salvador, and South Africa to talk about rebuilding their divided nations. And we want to spend a few minutes today speaking with some of the participants. We're joined by Padraig O'Malley, Professor of Peace and Reconciliation in the McCormick Graduate School of Policy Studies at UMass Boston. He organized this conference and others. Padraig, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you, Robin.
We're also joined by Mary Burton. She served as a commissioner of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. She's been a member of the Black Sash, a human rights group comprised of white South African women, since she arrived in South Africa in 1961. Mary, welcome to you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we're joined as well by Piers Pigou. He was an investigator for the South African Truth Commissions. He now serves as director of the South African History Archive. Piers, welcome to you.
Thanks, Robin.
And Padraig, let's start with you. What's the goal here?
The goal is very simple, to bring together key people from Northern Ireland who have been dealing with these issues of the past, together with people from four countries that have already had truth commissions. They are sharing their experiences and what they would do again if they had to do it differently.
We spoke to you recently when you brought Iraqis together with people from South Africa who had been through the process. So this is something that you feel works. And Mary Burton, I just want to ask you, bring you into the conversation as someone from the South African process. Is it transferable? Because when people look at the situation in Northern Ireland or in Iraq in particular, they say, yeah, but there's no Nelson Mandela. You hear that over and over again, that the reason reconciliation worked as well as it did in South Africa was because of this person that people could trust and could wrap their arms around.
I don't think that any process is transferable from one country to another in exactly the same format. Yes, of course, we were very lucky in South Africa to have a man of the caliber of Nelson Mandela. But these processes of reconciliation don't depend on one person. They depend on the will of people to talk about things that are very painful and to find ways of moving from that conflicted past into what ought to be a better future for everybody.
Well, give me for instance, because Padraig was just saying the goal is for people like yourself to say what maybe you would have done differently. Do you actually give examples? I mean, are there examples of something that, here's how hard this was for me?
Well, we've just come out of a session working with some of the people from Northern Ireland, looking for what the experience was like for the victims. And of course, victims give up a great deal in telling their stories, in accepting some form of amnesty, often for the perpetrators. What can one do for them? And we were exploring some of the mistakes that we made in South Africa, perhaps promising too much, perhaps expecting too much, but nevertheless, a process that worked for us.
Well, Piers, I want to bring you in on that. You and Mary, both white. And what would you say to someone who would say, of course you think truth and reconciliation works because you were white in South Africa, so let's just have a commission and people get to apologize and then we move on?
It's important to remember in the South African context that we had an extremely powerful process that affected all South Africans. Love it or hate it, you couldn't ignore it. It was there for all to see. But regrettably, the ball was dropped after the commission, and many of the processes and recommendations that the South African Commission made have not been properly taken up. And one of my contributions yesterday was around the issue of feeding back information to communities and constituencies. The South African Commission produced a wide-ranging and extensive report, but most South Africans have not even seen or heard what the findings were in the recommendations of the commission. There's been no distribution of that. So that's one practical example of what should not be done in any commission process that's undertaken in Northern Ireland.
I wonder if you speak to people from Northern Ireland or Serbia, and I know you've done work in East Timor. Do people just perceive you as a white who was, you know, on one side of the apartheid divide? Do they approach you if perhaps they're on the power side and, you know, the conflict that they're in? Do they ask you about that? Do they ask you about power sharing, your experience?
It's not that kind of engagement. I think people are interested about minority fears, and that's been a very useful aspect of this interface with people from Northern Ireland. There are certain parallels between the loyalist Protestant communities and the fears and convictions that they hold with elements within our own white community, particularly from the Afrikaner section of the population, a community who feel that they've been left behind and have lost from the negotiations. And it's a question of what kind of reassurances have been given to communities in South Africa. Has the fear of being swamped by a black majority actually materialized? What's happened to those people? So I think it's dealing with insecurities, it's dealing with fears, and also trying to see how we can make processes as inclusive as possible.
Mary, we've been focusing on Northern Ireland and South Africa, but, you know, do people from El Salvador, Guatemala, do they, you know, are they on the sidelines kind of watching, or do they feel like they fit into this conversation?
Oh, no, they're participating very fully in this process, and it's interesting to see how different some of their experiences have been.
Well, how different?
They come from a confrontation which is clearly between a military government, very oppressive, mm-hmm. of a poor peasant population. And that once a peace accord has been reached, a commission of some kind, a truth commission of some kind, helps to move forward from that conflict-ridden past to a better understanding. The people from El Salvador, for example, are very convinced that they have a wonderful process and that that has taken them into a completely transformed society. They were talking today about how their military forces have been completely transformed, which is a really fascinating concept.
So it wasn't a matter of just removing from power that military that was responsible for whatever infractions there were. It's a matter of changing the very notion of the military.
Yes, and exactly changing power relationships within a society.
Huh. One of the themes which has been interesting coming out of this has been the role of external actors. And of course, the United States has come up repeatedly in relation to some of the conflicts that have taken place and the need to be able to engage with the role of external actors. That's, again, part of the unfinished business in all the commissions.
That's Piers Bagoo of South Africa. Porig O'Malley brought Piers and Mary together with people from other countries. And so, Porig, I want to close with you on that question. Is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission complete if a third actor, such as the United States, is seen as a participant in the problems but isn't at the table?
This will definitely be a factor in Northern Ireland. The British government will take a position that there can be any kind of truth and reconciliation process, and they will fund it, but that it will be between Catholics and Protestants, that they are not responsible for anything except for trying to keep the peace. The Catholic nationalist community would obviously see the British as a prime player in any truth-seeking process, that they must be held accountable. The Protestant community, on the other hand, would see it as their government being put in the box. So there's that divide that exists. But the fact that we are talking about reconciliation in Northern Ireland is hopeful in the sense that 15 years ago, few people would be talking about it.
Thanks as always, Porig. That's Porig O'Malley. We also spoke with Mary Burton, who served on South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and Piers Bagoo, an investigator on that commission. They're all in Boston as part of a Truth and Reconciliation Conference at UMass Boston this week. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. When we come back, Truth and Reconciliation in Liberia. And later in the program, is your house haunted by insurance claims? Here and Now. We've been talking today about what happens when societies are torn apart by violence. What happens after a civil war, when once vicious enemies find themselves living next door to one another again? How do they reconcile that violent past? Well, that's a question now being asked in Liberia, as that country attempts to come to grips with its violent past, a brutal 14-year civil war that came to an end in 2003 when President Charles Taylor was forced to flee the country. Taylor is accused of leading a reign of terror in Liberia and in neighboring Sierra Leone, resulting in an estimated 400,000 deaths and fighting characterized by excessive brutality and the use of child soldiers. Taylor's now awaiting trial at The Hague. Well, earlier this month, 8 Liberian journalists visited Boston, in part to see how American media outlets work. 2 of them spent some time at Here Now Studios. Isaac Ye and Tawan Brown both worked for UNMIL Radio in Liberia. That's standing for the United Nations Mission in Liberia. I asked them for their thoughts about truth and reconciliation in Liberia. With so much bloodshed, can it work? First up, Tawan Brown.
This idea came about organizing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission instead of a war crimes court like one that is in Sierra Leone to reunite the people of Liberia, where people can go to tell their stories and the wounds can be healed, you know, by perpetrators coming out asking for forgiveness. And this is the reason why the Truth and Reconciliation was put together, to bring back the people of Liberia together.
It is very idealistic, but Isaac, you know, the first thought would be if somebody came out and told a story on their neighbor, told what someone did to them, isn't there a greater fear if it's only truth and reconciliation as opposed to a war crimes trial? That person is not going to be arrested or put in jail. I mean, you know, what doesn't that endanger people if they tell the story?
Well, the way the TRC is established, the TRC is not a court, but it's got subpoena power.
It's not a court, but it does have subpoena power.
It does. So if there is a story too about the next person and there's a need for the person to be brought forward, this subpoena power will be issued and that person will come. And, well, there are options. If you intend to have these hearings, your hearing behind closed doors, yes, you can do that. And information from there will not be leaked out. So, well, it works in many ways. There are people who say, no, I want to say the story in the presence of the press, in the presence of the television camera. These are real stories. These are life-telling stories about people's involvement with the crisis.
So you can have it in private, as you said, behind closed doors, or you can declare it to the world if you want.
Yeah.
And there is a subpoena power. Are the stories then, Isaac, being told elsewhere? I mean, are people getting to hear these stories?
Yes. On the formal launch of the TRC, there were very, very interesting stories told. Mm-hmm. People came out and talk about massacres. Talk about wars. That program doesn't exist anymore, but Army Radio ran a program for almost 2 years.
Straight from the heart.
Who ran this program, Straight from the Heart?
One of our colleagues ran the program Straight from the Heart, and they brought in ex-combatants.
Even victims.
I mean, you hear very horrifying stories. People killed, and they went on the radio and said, yes, I did. I killed a whole family. I apologize. I want forgiveness. People who were victimized themselves appear on the radio. And they talk about forgiving. That was not the TRC, really. It was just a radio program. So I think people are beginning to understand the issue about telling the truth as a way of writing our history, not to sort of penalize anybody, but let us know how far we come from, how far we've injured our own country.
I'm wondering, Tawan, 4 years ago, you worked for Charles Taylor Radio when he was president. And as we said, he's now awaiting trial. Were you one of his admirers? I mean, and what happens to you if you work for his radio station?
It was like working for Charles Taylor. You were branded by other, you know, persons within the media spectrum. There was this mentality that Taylor was, you know, the worst person. He rained terror on the country and all of that. So if you are associated with Taylor, it's like you are part of that particular group. And so it was actually difficult, you know, working with Taylor. And there was a lot of reason behind that. A lot of people work for Taylor for different reasons.
Why did you?
One, it was the career that I picked. And the second was somehow the source of survival, because he had to survive. And then if you live within that terrain at the time under the forces of Charles Taylor, sometimes you may have a safe passage because people knew you as a journalist working on their side. But even in the midst of that, those you work with could not even trust you because they felt that, you know, you were a spy. So you had to be very careful.
So you want to do this work, but on the one hand, you know that people are stigmatizing you as being, you know, one of Charles Taylor's employees at his radio station. On the other hand, even within the radio station, people aren't sure of you and think maybe you're a spy from outside.
Those are the challenges, yeah.
You know, Isaac, we understood that if this were a few years ago and you were journalists coming to America, you might not go back.
So true.
Yeah, tell me.
So true. I mean, yes, that's a very good question. If we have eight journalists, not a single one intend to stay. If this was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, all eight would never go back, including myself.
And what does that say? What are you saying? That
it's because I'm telling you that the conditions back home, the conditions have improved. We should be called a failed state.
Mm-hmm. A failed state.
Now we've been called a developing state. I mean, I'm telling you how fast our president and the government and the people are working to restore a nation of people staying home. The war has brought brain drain.
Everybody leaving, yep.
Everybody leaving. Most of the top journalists are either in the United States or somewhere else. The doctors have left. The educators have left. We have professors here. We go to the schools here. We see our own professors.
Here in America.
Yeah, yeah. They went to school here, went back home, but they had to leave because of the 14 years of fighting. Yeah. So the situation is changing. I mean, journalists can come to America today and go back home. Speaks of the level of first peace, the level of development that is obtaining back home. So, I mean, it's okay now.
Yeah. Isaac Yeh, thank you, Isaac.
Thank you so much.
Tawan Brown, thank you, Tawan.
Thank you.
Both of UNMIL Radio, that's United Nations Mission in Liberia Radio, two of eight Liberian journalists visiting the U.S. Okay, and still ahead today, we're going to check in on the California wildfires and their effect on insurance. A consumer advocate says homes carry a history of damages and claims that companies use to determine if they'll cover your house. Back after the news here and now. Residents in Southern California are assessing their losses today. Despite a break in the winds, fires in San Diego County are still raging. Two charred bodies were found in a burned house. President Bush has declared a major disaster. Over 8,000 homes are still threatened, over 1,500 in ruins. The estimates of property damage have topped $1 billion. So what does this mean for insurance? California is the largest market for homeowners insurance in the country, but Allstate announced earlier this year that it would no longer underwrite new California homeowner policies because of fears of wildfires and earthquakes, and there may be some other hidden problems. David Lazarus writes the Consumer Confidential column for the Los Angeles Times. David, you quote someone in your column as saying that Californians are discovering their houses are haunted with past insurance claims. Explain that.
Well, who would have guessed that property owners are actually held accountable for the people who used to live in their homes? But that, it turns out, is the case. I was looking into the challenges faced by people affected by these fires if they file and when they file claims. It's well known, that old phrase, use it and lose it, in the insurance industry. You file a claim, and before you know it, your rates are going up, or worse, they're dropping you as a policyholder because, God forbid, you're actually somebody who's going to use the product. So as I looked into this, I discovered that there are huge privately run databases out there that all insurers kick claims into and all insurers can access. And what does that mean? It means, first of all, that your insurance history is accessible to all insurers. So every claim you file could affect rates with other insurers. So a claim filed with insurer ABC could turn into higher rates with insurer XYZ, even though your record with that insurer is absolutely spotless. Even more insidious is the fact that this database also reflects claims made on specific properties. Therefore, the house that you buy might come with higher insurance rates, not because you filed claims, but because the former owner of the house had filed claims.
This is sort of like a credit score for a house.
Well, it's precisely that. It's an insurance score, and that's going to be, I think, eye-opening for a lot of consumers, the fact that the insurance industry does assign insurance scores to all of us. They don't tell us about this. They don't tell us what our scores are, and yet industry players behind the scenes are routinely assigning and using these scores to determine what our rates are and whether, in fact, we'll even get coverage.
So to give an example, let's say you purchase a home. You've had a terrific record. You haven't had house fires. You haven't had any issues, but let's say the previous owner was in a house fire, was in an earthquake, and had filed claims for that. That goes against your insurance costs.
You will be held accountable for the claims made from a total stranger who was there before you even took possession. And you know what's really remarkable is, when they buy a house. Most people will make renovations. They will make improvements. They will find things that aren't good enough, and they'll make them better. Those improvements, in theory, should make you a better insurance risk and should lead to lower rates. And yet, when I talk to the company that's behind the main database here, the people at ChoicePoint told me that, no, this is a database of losses, not of repairs. Therefore, none of the renovations a homeowner does to his or her property are reflected in the database, and how can that possibly be an accurate reflection of the insurance risk?
Well, as our listeners can hear, David, you are a staunch defender of the consumer. But just a little pushback here. You know, insurance companies are in the business of risk. Isn't it a good thing for them to know if a home has been in the track of a lot of wildfires? That helps them assess what the risk of that house is.
It is absolutely a good thing for them to know. Obviously, the more information an insurer has, the better a decision that insurer can make about rates and coverage. There's no question about that. I think the real issues here are ones of transparency. First of all, most consumers have no idea that these databases are being used. But second of all, these databases need to be an accurate reflection of the risk posed by a property owner. So if a specific property owner has not filed a lot of claims, or if that property owner has made extensive renovations to his or her property, that is also information relevant to these decisions. When you have a database that only shows the bad but doesn't show the good, you're not getting an even playing field.
For instance, that new homeowner may have gone out and cleared all the brush for 100 yards around the house, or even built a moat or some kind of a firewall, but that would not go into this database.
Well, what that means is basically the customer's not getting a fair shake.
Well, David, tell us a little more about the peculiarities of California insurance in particular. We said already that Allstate has decided not to insure new homeowners, and yet it's one of the biggest markets for insurers overall. We understand on Wednesday an insurance state of emergency was declared in the state, which allows out-of-state claims adjusters not licensed in California to come in to handle claims. Why is that important?
Well, that's important because obviously you want to make these claims go as smoothly and as quickly as possible. And to the credit of the insurance companies, they are deploying hundreds of people throughout the region trying to get them into the disaster areas to meet with the people who will be making claims and try and make it as smooth as possible. I don't want to imply that the insurance industry is simply out to rip people off. They're not, and they're certainly stepping up to the plate here and trying to reach out to their customers and get these procedures going quickly. The problem here is all the stuff that happens behind the scenes, and that's not what the consumer ever sees. The adjustment of rates, the setting of rates, the denial of coverage, which is in fact a growing problem every time you have something like this. When we had the Cedar Fire back in 2003, which devastated vast portions of San Diego, the number of what the insurance industry calls non-renewals of policies spiked sharply higher. Well, what does that tell you? It tells you that the insurance industry looks at people who make significant and substantial claims and says, well, I don't want to do business with that person anymore. And yet that sort of raises good questions about what is the insurance product? Isn't this exactly what this product is supposed to be used for?
Well, David, a lot of people might say we also know California had a form of special authority to sell earthquake coverage after all the insurers threatened to leave after the 1994 Northridge earthquake. So there have been these huge spasms in California. What do you say to people across the country who say, you know what, I'm glad because that's a nationwide insurance company. I participate with them as well. And I don't want my rates driven up by all these people who are foolish enough to live in the path of a forest fire or on a fault line.
Well, that's a fair thing to say, but it's also extremely short-sighted. The nature of insurance is to spread the risk as broadly and as evenly as possible. It's the old saw about it takes a village. Well, insurance literally is that village, but on a national scale. So, my insurance risk in Southern California might be a bit more substantial than somebody living in the middle of the prairies out in the Midwest. But at the same time, my insurance risk also reflects people in Florida who seem to be getting gobsmacked by hurricanes every other week. So it all evens out over the long run.
David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times with strong opinions about the insurance industry. David, thanks for sharing them with us.
Pleasure's all mine.
And
And by the way, my apologies to half my family living in the path of forest fires and fault lines in California. This reminder, you can listen to our show stream live on our website, here-now.org. For past programs, you can always just click on the archives, or you can download a free podcast, Take Us With You When You Go. And before we go today, what's the best rock and roll hit to come out of your town? You're listening to Here and Now. That's a Morse code message, but it's not an SOS from a distressed ship at sea. Here is the English translation.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness.
A Morse code version of A Tale of Two Cities? Why not, says Chuck Adams. He's one of the world's fastest Morse code operators, and for the past year he's been translating books, mostly classic boys' literature, into Morse code, even as the language is dying off, or maybe because it is. And Chuck Adams joins us from his home in Prescott, Arizona. Chuck, bear with me here. Dit-da-da, dit-dit-da-dit-da, da-dit-da-dit-da-da-da-da-da-dit.
Oh, welcome to my home, Robin.
You knew. You got it.
Well, it was kind of slow, but it was pretty good. You only had one mistake, but we don't worry about those little things.
Well, no, let's hear you do welcome in dit-da.
Da-da-da, dit, da-da-dit, da-da-da-dit, da-da-da, da-da-dit.
Well, okay, I'm impressed. And we understand that you are tied for the eighth fastest code communicator in the world. 140 words a minute?
That's receiving call letters, radio amateur call letters. I am number one in my age bracket.
Which is 65 plus.
Yes.
So congratulations on that. And now you've decided to take on, you know, translating kids' books into the code. Why are you doing that?
I'm doing that to give anyone that wants to practice Morse code with plain text an opportunity to receive it.
Right. Well, we understand since 1999, ships at sea no longer send distress calls with the Morse code of SOS, which would be what? That would be dit, 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 da, 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 dit, dit, dit.
Very good.
There's a new satellite and computer system. The military, which used Morse code with great success in World Wars, no longer trains Morse code operators. And the Federal Communication Commission has eliminated the Morse code requirement for obtaining a ham radio operator's license. People are pretty upset. Is Morse code really good for anything at this point except nostalgia? I mean, do you really see it serving any kind of emergency need?
Yes. An example recently would be Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans.
Well, I mean, that does seem like a good example, though, of how Morse code can be used.
There is one technology where you can still use Morse code. On some cell phones, there is the possibility to enter text using the left and right arrow as a dit and da, and you can text without looking at your phone, which I think teenagers need to learn. There have been a number of tragic deaths of teenagers texting while driving an automobile and have a fatal accident.
Huh.
You don't need that. Also, you can pass messages during class without the teacher knowing it.
Well, now, let's not encourage that. So let's get to more of what you're doing for kids. You've translated about a dozen books into Morse code. Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. Let's listen to a little of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. Now, when I'm hearing these dits and das, you know, if I'm a young person just learning Morse code, I'm really concentrating. How do these things sound to you? Do you hear them as different letters or do you hear them as words?
It depends upon the speed. At slower speeds, I hear them as individual letters, and then at faster speeds, I hear them as words. It's like reading. The psychologists have shown that you don't need every letter in a word while you're reading to understand what the word is.
Yeah.
That occurs frequently in Morse code.
Well, now, I understand that you just translated the King James Version of the Bible for an army doctor in Iraq.
Yes, ma'am.
Why did he want that on Morse code?
It's his personal interest in the Bible, and in particular the King James Version.
Chuck Adams is a Morse code operator in Prescott, Arizona, who's translating classic literature and the King James Bible into code in hopes people will learn and keep the language alive. We'll leave you with some of his translation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds in code. Chuck, thanks.
Thank you. Did.
We're going to take a break. Think about the best song to come out of your hometown. We'll explain when we come back Here and Now. Okay, now I'm worried. The Red Sox clobbered the Colorado Rockies 13-1 last night here in Boston's Fenway Park in Game 1 of the World Series. So like a true Sox fan, I'm convinced the Rockies' loss is some sort of secret plan to throw us off balance, that a little humility is in order. Remember when the Yankees beat Pittsburgh 16-3 in 1960 and then went on to lose in 7? It's all about my town. They're down by the river. Down by the banks of the River Charles. Well, today we plan to crow about all the great music that comes from Beantown, the songs that propelled the Red Sox to greatness, the Standells' Dirty Water, Aerosmith, the Cars. I mean, come on, what does Denver have besides Rocky Mountain High? But in case the baseball gods are listening in, we're not bragging. We're just humbly offering an opportunity for you to think about the songs that come from your town. That's Buffalo Tom's Soda Jerk, one of 64 songs competing to be the best hit out of Beantown in the past 25 years. It's a contest held by the Boston Herald and rock station WBCN. It was Michael Murata's idea. He writes about the Boston music scene for the Herald. He joins us now. Welcome.
Hello.
And he put together the list with Carrie Purcell. She's a music writer. Her weekly column, Meet the Band, explores Boston's thriving music scene. Welcome to you as well, Carrie.
Thank you.
And I understand that what you did, Michael, was you came up with an original list and then you had radio listeners and paper readers write in.
We figured we'd never be able to come up with a list that would satisfy everyone. So kind of one way out of that was saying, you know, we came up with the songs that we loved and we thought were the best songs that came out of Boston. And then we let people went to the website, suggest their own. And
well, now I jump in to say that, you know, we're riding pretty high on ourselves right now. You know, we're in the World Series and we think, oh, we're the mecca. We do have some good music. I mean, Detroit would kick our butt.
Yeah, Boston can compete with pretty much anything. I mean, you know, you have your New York and Los Angeles, but the thing with those cities is, you know, those people move there from other places where, you know, here in Boston, it's more of a homegrown feel. And the music that comes out of the city really reflects the culture of the city. And you know, you look at the Dropkick Murphys and the Departed, and, you know, it really defines the area that we're in.
Dropkick Murphys, the theme song also of the Boston Red Sox. Why don't we hear a little Tessie?
The Red Sox have won baseball World Championship. Can you believe it?
Tessie is the royal root, his rally cry. Tessie is the tune they always sung. Tessie echoed April through October night. After serenade installed in Indian Yard.
Well, let's start with your lists. Carrie, why don't you give us a few of the bands that you think are, you know, should have this honor of the best song to come out of Boston?
Well, I think Damone is definitely a front runner.
Well, you know, let me ask you, though, because I've noticed on both your lists some very new bands. who's winning, the newer bands or, the, you know, Aerosmith, the band Boston? Who seems to be doing well in the voting, Michael?
I think the way we set it up was that there would be an equal amount of older bands and newer bands kind of coming together. A lot of the pairings that we did, you know, we had, you know, two older bands would battle it out in the first round and, you know, two newer bands would battle it out in the first round. And then they've just kind of move on from there.
You've got Till Tuesday with Voices Carry up against Drive, the Cars. Mm-hmm. You've got Living on the Edge, Aerosmith battling with Boston's We're Ready. I mean, who won that one?
Aerosmith. There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. And God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise. Yeah! We're living on the edge. So what are some of your picks, Michael? I've said from the beginning that, Till Tuesday's Voices Carry is one of my favorite songs. So that's my dark horse pick to win it all.
Amy Mann,
yeah.
What are some of your other picks?
Some of the picks, The Information, A Simple Plan. An interesting round two matchup is the Stearns, their classic song, This Will Only Hurt for a Minute, is up against New Kids on the Block, The Right Stuff. So, you picture 4 or 5 early 20s kids hanging out in Alston, which is a Boston neighborhood, and they're up against New Kids on the Block.
Well, it's unfair. New Kids on the Block made it to the second round because in the first round they were up against themselves.
Right.
It's kind of like
a free pass.
Step by Step was up against You've Got It, The Right Stuff, yeah. New Kids on the Block. Carrie, what do you think, this even says about Boston, this contest, as you look at the, I know you do the edgy now bands in your column, but as you look at this 25 years of music, what does it say about Boston?
I think Boston's music scene is so diverse. I mean, between the New Jack Swing from New Edition and Bobby Brown to, the garage of the Pixies and the soft sort of more folky sound of the Pernice Brothers from Dorchester, we really run the gamut.
I'm wondering, Peter Wolf, Jay Giles, did they get in the competition?
They might have missed the
They
date.
Missed the cutoff of 25 years.
Oh!
If you look at the actual recording date of their tunes, they miss it by a couple years or more if you're thinking about Jay Giles.
A lot of people just suddenly felt really old. Well, there are a lot of artists who don't make that cut. James Taylor, of course, singing about fire and rain while driving on the Mass Turnpike. The Standells' Dirty Water. Who else didn't make the cut?
Please Come to Boston by Dave Loggins.
Please come to Boston, she said no. Will you come home to me?
There's actually a line in that song that he also says, please come to Denver.
Oh my gosh.
Which really just brings it all.
It brings it all together. Sort of a kumbaya moment.
Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline, which, depending on your point of view, has either been ruined or celebrated by Red Sox fans.
With Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline. He doesn't come from here, but who cares? It's the mid-eighth inning anthem of the Boston Red Sox. Courtesy of Here Now's Kurt Nickisch, who was at the game last night. Michael Marotta writes about the Boston music scene for the Boston Herald, as does Carrie Purcell. When will the winner of the contest be announced?
November 16th.
November 16th. Okay. So cast your vote.
Thank you both.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay, then. Phoenix, Boise, Philly, points between. Tell us the best song to come out of your town. Go to here-now.org. Click on the City Songs button to register your pick, and we'll let others know what you think. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Warm, touching warm, reaching out.